Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, I'd like to welcome all of you to Ohio Expo Politics. I've got a terrible connection on the phone line here. So I am going to play a little more of these nature sounds and call right back in. Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Expo Politics. I'm your host, Mark. And we are just having all sorts of problems this evening. I don't know if you can hear that static or not, but let me try and continue the show here if possible. I'm going to pick up in the Talmud of Emmanuel. This is in chapter 34. And this is the older translation of the Talmud. It has some problems in it. So I'll try to kind of correct these as I go. Emmanuel preached powerfully, saying, "Behold, creation stands above humanity." And then it says, "above God." Here's where I think this translation, this should be above the Ishwish, above the King of Wisdom, and above everything. It appears to be perfect by human comprehension. But this is not so. Since creation is spirit and thus lives, even it must forever perfect itself. But since it is one within itself, it can dwell, it can perfect itself by way of its creations through the generation of new spirit forms that dwell within humans, give them life, evolve towards perfect through their learning. Newly generated spirit is part of creation itself. However, it is unknowing down to the smallest iota. When a new spirit is still unknowing in every way, then a human body. Now, this is going to talk to us a little bit about reincarnation here in a second. What I'm going to try to do, play a clip on reincarnation and then try once their connection. This is just crazy.
This little boy is referred to as Sam in case studies. A year and a half before he was born, his grandfather died.
When he was about 18 months old, his dad was changing his diaper one day, and Sam looked up at him and said, "When I was your age, I used to change your diaper."
Since 1996, Dr. Jim Tucker, a psychiatrist at the University of Virginia, has been gathering case studies of past life recognition in children that could prove that a soul returns to Earth in another body.
We've now got 2,500 cases in our files from all over the world.
Many people believe in some form of reincarnation. The concept dates back to 800 BC and the Hindu Upanishads. Beginning in India, the belief that some essential part of ourselves may return after death to a new body is now being examined by some scientists as another way to prove the survival of consciousness. Can the study of past life recollections support this theory? The answer may lie within young children's memories.
Very young children, usually between the age of 2 or 3, who start reporting that they have memories from having had a past life. Some of them talk about being deceased relatives, but others will talk about being strangers in other locations. And if they give enough details, like the name of the other location, people have often gone there and found that, in fact, someone had died in the recent past whose life matches the details that the children gave.
The late psychiatrist Dr. Ian Stevenson advanced the field of reincarnation research in the 1960s, interviewing over 3,000 people who claimed to have past life memories. 2/3 of them said that in a previous life, they died from unusual causes. He focused on 25 cases in India and realized that young children talking about past lives was much more common than anyone had known. Dr. Stevenson created categories to screen for cases worthy of further study. His colleague, Jim Tucker, still uses this method.
The criteria we use to decide whether to register a case would include two of the following characteristics: a prediction of rebirth, an announcing dream, a birthmark or birth defect that seems related to the previous life, statements of memories about the previous life, behaviors that seem related, and then...
Okay, folks, I think I've finally made a good connection via Skype. I'm sorry for the little interruption there. That is some information by Dr. Ian Stevenson, who did a lot of research on reincarnation and evidence of past lives. And I'd actually like to listen to that in a little more detail in some future show, but there's just so much interesting information I wanted to talk about here from this particular book. Let me continue here. It's talking about a newly created spirit form, which is unknowing in every way, and it lives in a human body and begins to learn. This is, again, chapter 34 from the older translation of the Talmud of Emmanuel. Persons may consider the unknowing spirit as stupid and say that the individual is confused, but it is not, because it is only unknowing and devoid of knowledge and wisdom. Thus, may this new spirit live a life within a human in order to gather wisdom. Then, when the spirit enters the beyond, it is no longer as unknowing as it was at the time of its beginning, and returns into the world and lives again as a human being, but it is no longer quite as unknowing as it was in the beginning. Again, it learns and gathers further knowledge and new wisdom. Thereby, increasingly, it escapes from ignorance. So after many renewed lives, the time comes when people say this spirit is normal and not confused. So when we start our first incarnation with a brand new spirit, and this probably happened about 4 to 5 million years ago, for most human beings are on the earth now. We had no knowledge whatsoever. Each lifetime, we gain a little knowledge. That knowledge from the previous life is stored in your subconscious mind, and it consists of the essences of all the wisdom that you learned in the previous life. The essences would include patience and love and all the different virtues that you had gathered up in the previous life. So even though you're a baby, you still in your subconscious have that wisdom, and it will send you hunches or impulses as you start to grow up again. Your material consciousness has to grow up again. So after many renewed lives, the times come when the people say that this spirit is normal and it is not confused, but this is neither the end of the spirit nor its fulfillment, because having becoming knowing, the spirit now seeks the greatest wisdom. Thus the human spirit perfects itself so extensively that it unfolds in a creational manner and ultimately becomes one with creation, as it was destined to from the earliest beginning. Remember, there are 7 evolutionary steps. that human spirits go through. We here on the earth are generally in stage two, primitive life, rational life. Our spirit forms are about 5 million years old. The next stage is intelligent life, if we don't destroy ourselves. The fourth stage is real life. The fifth stage is the stage of the Ishwish, the king of wisdom. The sixth stage is half spiritual, half physical. We stay there, I think, almost a billion years. And then we go into a purely spiritual state for about a billion years again. And then we merge back with creation. Let me continue here in the Talmud. It says, thus creation has brought forth a new spirit, allowing it to be perfected independently in the human body. The perfected spirit returns to creation to become one with it. And in this manner, creation perfects itself within itself. So this is interesting because creation right now is not perfect. And this is the difference between the religious idea of God and the Meyer information that talks about a universal consciousness. The universal consciousness is evolving, and it creates human spirits as a part of its own evolution. You see, we're kind of boots on the ground. We're down here in the physical creation. We spend time in the spiritual, time in the physical, and we go back and forth between these two states. And we continue to grow in wisdom. We learn more each lifetime, and we gather more and more wisdom. And we evolve through these seven evolutionary steps, and then we bring the wisdom we've gathered back to creation, and then we merge with creation again. And that's the plan that the Meyer material says. Now, creation, our universe has a universal consciousness, which created this physical universe 46 trillion years ago. And it's been expanding, and it will continue to expand for about 155 trillion years. And then it will contract, I believe, about the same amount of time, and it goes into a sleep state before it expands again in another kind of universe. So the universe, this universal intelligence, is evolving. It's becoming wiser. It's perfecting itself. Now, if you wanted to see evidence for the lack of perfection in the universe, the one real thing I would point out, and this is not mentioned in the Meyer material at all, this is just one of my own ideas, my own thoughts, is if you can see the way animals prey on each other, the predatory animal will kill the prey animal. And I think that's some of the evidence of our universe not being perfect yet. And I bet you, my hunch is that in the other universes, that this universal consciousness will create, there won't be that kind of thing that goes on. Because there are 10 to the 49th power number of universal forms that a universe goes through. We're in the first stage of our evolution as a universe. So let me continue here in Talmud. Truly I say to you, the time will never come when creation ceases to create new spirit forms and to broaden itself. However, creation requires rest, and that's what I talked about. After the contraction phase, creation will rest, and rest is a characteristic of all that lives. When it slumbers, it does not create. Just the way we sleep every night, creation goes into a sleep phase that probably lasts trillions of years. I'd have to look at my notes. Its period is, however, different from that of people because its laws are the laws of the spirit. While human laws are the laws of material life, material life is limited, but the life of the spirit lasts forever, and it has no end. Now, there is a very long verse here that I think they just may have pulled from somewhere else and thrown in, and I'm not going to read it all. But it talks about something called the absolutum, which I think is the final evolutionary stage of our universe. Our universe is in the lowest form of creation. It's a material universe. Something that I find a little disturbing is trying to understand that, you know, the material state is the lowest form of evolution. I find that very strange. The absolutum is the idea-related procreative power only, out of which the lowest creation form, that is our Dern universe, came forth. Let me continue here. Its secret is that which is immeasurable and is based on the number 7, which is counted in times. This is one of the secrets in the laws the human mind will solve only when it reaches perfection. I don't know if you notice, but the number 7 appears in the Meyer material, particularly in the 7 evolutionary steps of humanity. Once we reach the final phase of evolution, in the spiritual stage, there are 7 steps in that spiritual stage. So you see the number 7 appear a lot. This is one of the secrets in the laws of the human mind. It will solve only when it reaches perfection. But let it be said that the laws of life are not hidden from the wise man, hence he can recognize and follow them. Now I'm going to, continue here. Creation rested in a state of slumber for 7 great times when nothing existed. So the time of rest is measured and described as 7 great times. So every universal consciousness, the universe expands. It goes into an expansion phase for like 150 some trillion years, and then it goes into a contraction phase the last trillions of years, and then it goes into a rest phase, which is called a slumber, which lasts for 7 great times. Only creation itself existed in the slumber, and it brought forth no creature. There is no creatures during this sleep phase of the universe. Continues verse 30. However, it did not awaken from its slumber through the 7 cycles of 7 great times, and it did awaken from its slumber through 7 cycles of 7 great times, and it began to create creatures and everything. And after having rested for 7 cycles of 7 great times, it is now creating living organisms and everything else. And it will do so for 7 more cycles of 7 great times until it requires rest once again, and it reposes anew in deep slumber for a further 7 great times. That's a good question, and off the top of my head, I don't remember what the 7 great times are all about. And we're going to have to look that up here in a little bit, but let me continue. When it will rest again and lie down in slumber, nothing will exist except for creation itself. When creation is in its slumber phase, there is nothing that exists but creation. Now, this is one of the great things I learned from this material that I'm going to try to put into words, is that there really is a oneness to everything in creation. And even our spirit, for example, the body is a part of the spirit, but it's in a different form and a different matter. And therefore, it is not two. The body and the spirit are not two. They're actually one. There's not a duality here. So that is the difference. Okay, creation itself exists in a conscious, creative state for 7 great times. Subsequently, it lays dormant for an equal number of great times. But this time they last seven times as long. Following this period, creation is awake to once again, for a period seven times as long once again, longer than the previous one. Now, the one great time is 311040 followed by 3690s. So that would probably be 311 trillion years, I'm guessing. So, again, that's a longer time than we can ever imagine as a human being. Only creation itself will exist during the seven cycles of the seven great times. Just as creation is one within itself, however, so is all life, being, and existence one within itself. A person may believe that everything is two or three, but that is not so because everything is one. Whatever people believe to be two or three is actually one. So they should make everything that is two or three into one. Since the spirit in a person is a part of creation, it is one with creation. Consequently, it is not two. So we think of ourselves, our spirit, as separate from creation. But it's not really. There's a oneness to everything in the universe. And since the body is a part of the spirit in a different form and matter, it is therefore one with the spirit. So the body and the spirit are really the same. The body is a part of the spirit. Consequently, it is not two. The teachings state that there is unity and not in any way form, a duality, not a trinity. If it appears to people that there is a duality or is a trinity, then they are the victims of deception, for they do not think logically, but according to human knowledge. Anyway, that was only about three pages, and I don't like to read that much typically during the show, but I thought that information was profound enough to just read and let it stand as it is. So, who is Edward Albert Meyer? Well, Edward Albert Meyer is a man from Switzerland. He's almost 80 years old now. He lives in a tiny mountain village in Switzerland called Hinterschmidruti. He's had extraterrestrial contact since about the age of 5 years old when he lived in northern Switzerland. Back about the time of World War II, he started to have his first contacts. A man named Svoth would land a silvery pear-shaped spacecraft near his home in Bulak, Switzerland. And Svoth would take him up in the ship and tell him about Billy's past lives and who he was. And according to Svoth, Billy had been the people that we today call Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And he always taught about creation. He always taught about the laws of creation and some of the creational natural laws that we've talked about before include the law of love, the law of effective love, the law of wisdom-conditioned love, the law of striving, that every creature has to strive to live, and the key to your happiness is how hard do you strive in your daily life? How hard are you working? How hard are you working at your current employment? How hard are you working to gain more wisdom, to gain more knowledge, to advance yourself? Your following the principle of striving is the key to your happiness. There's no happiness for the human being outside of striving. So if you want to understand how to be a happy person, then you have to learn to strive. You have to learn to continue to work. You have to learn to continue to focus and focus on striving. Striving is one of the greatest ways to fulfill your own happiness. And this, I'm going to read something from Billy's book, The Way to Live, page 102. It says, to be without striving means unwillingness and affliction. Affliction is inhibited striving and inhibited life. But inhibited striving and inhibited life bring inhibited evolution and stagnation, hopelessness and grief. Let me say something. If you're experiencing hopelessness, and I think we all fall into that from time to time, hopelessness is an indication that you're not working hard enough. You're not striving hard enough. Your spirit form is telling you to get on the ball and start working. So let me continue here. But inhibited striving and inhibited life bring inhibited evolution and stagnation, hopelessness and grief, confusion, irrationality, joylessness, cognitionlessness, unpeace, disharmony, lovelessness, resentment, lies, deceit, and reluctance for life. Focus yourself on striving and you'll avoid all of these horrible thoughts. Therefore, delectation, harmony, and happiness, as well as everything positive, as well as grief and everything negative, are in the end only the revelation of how pronounced the striving of the life form is. And this is probably what I would call the second most important creational natural law, and that is striving. And if you're feeling negative, if you're struggling with your thought forms right now, it's an indication that you need to be even more pronounced on your striving. That's one of the cosmos's, the creation's way of telling you that you need to work harder. Depending on the degree of the strength of the striving of any single vision, it will assert itself in the world and prevail, or will fall, shatter, waste away, and come to an end and vanish. The second creational natural law is striving. And it's so important to focus on your striving. Now, the third creational natural law that I want to talk about is something we've talked about before. It's called the law of harmony, the law of being. It's having neutral, positive thinking. You know, Billy, I was talking about Billy and Svath. Well, Svath was preparing Billy for a life of teaching. Svath knew about Billy's previous lives. Svath was aware of Billy's spirit form. He knew how ancient it was. He knew that it had been a teacher in previous times. I was talking about some of the teaching of Emmanuel earlier. That was one of the earlier incarnations of the spirit form that now resides in Edward Albert Meyer. We all have a spirit form. You and I have a spirit form. We just learned that the body is a part of the spirit form, and they're not a duality. They're really one. It's the spirit form is a different form in matter than the human body. Emmanuel is one of the material lifetimes of the spirit form that now enlivens the body of Edward Albert Meyer. He also had material lifetimes as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. Now, these people had different names during the time of their lives. And the most controversial thing probably in the Meyer case is the name, the term Emmanuel. And I actually tried to get to the bottom of this about half a year ago, maybe 8 months. Maybe it's been a year. Time goes so fast. And I didn't understand or think how in the world could the Western world be wrong about the name of the key figure in all the Western world, which is the person that we call today Jesus Christ. So I thought, well, how can the Meyer material possibly be right that his name was really Emmanuel? So I started to do research, and I stumbled across something. I stumbled across the fact that the letter J was the newest letter in the English alphabet. In other words, it didn't exist in Old English. The letter J did not even exist until about 1550. A man named Gian Giorgio Turrisino invented the letter J, and it originated as a swash letter of the I. It was used for the letter I at the end of Roman numerals. A swash letter is a fancy typographical flourish, such as an exaggerated serif. And that's how the letter J was invented. So Old English was spoken until about the 12th or 13th century. And there was no letter J in the Old English. Not only that, there was no letter J in the ancient world either. There was no letter J in the Hebrew, the Greek, the Aramaic. So the J sound was never pronounced by people in ancient times. It was always Yeshua or Jerusalem, not Julius Caesar. No, no, no. Not the book of Job, but the book of Iob. This was astounding to me. And again, I'm sit here and I was floored by the fact of how things have changed over time. There was no W, no J, or U in the Old English. And there's a great film on YouTube called The Letter J. And look it up sometimes, and you can listen to this and with awe, as I did. Even the names of James and John were changed. James' real name was Yaakov. Where John's name was something like, and I can't pronounce it even, it's Yakunan, Yahukanan. That's about as close as I'm going to get. Sorry, folks. So the emergence of the letter J came in Middle High German. Gian Giorgio Turrisino, he was actually an Italian scholar, but he knew German very well, and he invented the letter J. And that's when, about 1550, they started to get to distinguish between the I and the J sound. And some people say that the letter J was actually a mistake. So the letter J did not exist in Hebrew, Latin, or Greek. The answer is no to that. The letter J never existed in any languages on earth until 1500 or so. So we mispronounce all the names of the Hebrew prophets. For example, Elijah was actually known as Eliah, and Enoch was Henoch. So some people say that the original person that we call Jesus Christ today was named Yeshua in the Hebrew, and they say that the transliteration took place where Iesus in the Greek and then Isous in Latin, and Jesus in English. But the Meyer material says his name was originally Emmanuel. And Emmanuel in the German is der mit Gottlich Wissen, the one with godly knowledge, and with the knowledge of the Ishwish, or the king of wisdom. Now, Emmanuel is actually one of the old traditional first names of what's called the form. And the form is the most ancient. The Lyrians and the Vagans used this name, Emmanuel, and it's a very old name of a very true prophet. And that's from there, we probably have to get into the Talmud of Emmanuel and the story behind that, and Isa Rashid and that whole story, and we'll probably leave that for another show. One other thing I'd like to bring out real quick is the acronym INRI, and you'll see that on the old paintings from the Renaissance, the INRI. They'll be at the top or the bottom, which in the Latin means Iesus Nazarenus Rex Iodorium. and which we today would say Jesus Nazarene, King of the Jews, but they would say Iesus Nazarenus Rex, I adore him. So over the time, these names have changed, but the biggest confusion in terms of, I think the biggest confusion in terms of our religion is the idea of God, the idea of a perfect being, a heavenly father who is going to, in some way, shape, or form in the future, make everything A-OK. The Meyer material says there is a universal consciousness that creates spirit forms that live millions of physical lifetimes and evolve, and they become more and more responsible each lifetime if they're evolving properly. And so we're essentially responsible for ourselves. That's one of the primary teachings of the Meyer material, is that you are responsible for your own evolution. You're responsible for what you think. You're responsible for what you do. Your failures are a natural thing. You are going to fail. You're going to have problems. There's really no such thing in that sense as sin, because evolution involves failure and striving. And then success, failure, failure, striving, striving, and success. That's the nature of the reality that we live in. In Contact 501, Billy and Patah had a very interesting conversation about Issa Rashid in the Talmud of Emmanuel. And this is what Patah said at the very beginning of this discussion with Billy. He said, "That's right, of course. We already knew from the outset about the fallibility with regard to the translations and about certain important omissions." So they were talking about Issa Rashid and some of the problems in the original translation. Unfortunately, despite his aversion to the erroneous Christian teachings, he was imprisoned in his faith resulting from it, for this was deeply rooted within him, as it is with all religious believers. Consequently, he couldn't free himself from it completely, as this is the rule for all religious believers. But concerning his translation errors and omission errors, it is to be said that we deliberately let the whole thing run in the already executed manner, because there would have been too much turmoil at this time, and your life would have been endangered even more than it has been if you had published the entire actual translation of the scroll. Through a possibility forecast, we fathomed that you wouldn't have withstood everything, but rather you would have lost your life if you had spread the whole extent of the scroll at the time. Thus, we said nothing about this, and we waited until the aggressiveness had smoothed itself, which has now been the case for quite some time. It really was enough already that in the course of the years after the publication of Talmud Emmanuel, assassination attempts were perpetuated against you, and that you always only barely escaped the 22 attacks. Billy's had 22 attacks on his life. But now, since the first malicious waves have smoothed themselves, which were raised in certain circles because of the distribution of the book, the time has become ripe to work on the correct translation and to disseminate it. There is a new translation of the Talmud of Emmanuel that's just right around the corner from being released. Just to let you know. Of course, this will also cause unpleasant reactions in certain religious circles and among believers enslaved to faith in God, as well as among all your adversaries. But according to your judgment, this can no longer become a great danger for you. So this is Contact 501. Very interesting stuff about the Talmud of Emmanuel. More to come on that. There's an interesting, I don't know why I've suddenly been on the Talmud of Emmanuel kick. I'm going to step aside the laws and commandments taught in the Talmud and set that aside and come back to it later. I want to read a little bit of this here, the human being in creation. It came to pass that Emmanuel preached of the human being and of creation as he went eastward with a caravan. He said, human beings should look upwards to the stars for the majestic peace and grandeur. Rule there. As though by immutable law and order, the infinite and everlasting changes take place there over days, months, years, and beyond for centuries, millennia, and millions of years. And I thought that was a beautiful vision there. Human beings, however, should also look downward upon the earth, for there, as well as is creational activity and endless becoming and passing away of life and existence toward ever newly developing forms. Greatness, excellence, and beauty rule harmoniously where nature is left to itself. Now let's talk about leaving nature to itself. This is a very important topic, and let me put it this way. It says in the Meyer material, the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation, and creation radiates love, so that at every point and every time you can sense the radiating love of creation. Now, the sensing of creation's radiating love is called Empfinden in the German. And it's a purely spiritual process of what's called the Gemut in your spirit form. The Gemut controls the thoughts and feelings of your spiritual consciousness. And the Empfinden is this fine, sensitive feeling that you start to get when you're in nature and you're sensitive to nature. And go outside as much as you can and be in nature, because the negative ions will bring you life and will bring you health. This is how important nature is to us. And I started reading this little section where it's Emmanuel saying, look to the stars for majestic peace and grandeur. And I often go back to when Billy was a very young boy, when he crawled out that lower window and he looked up at the beautiful starry sky and he said, my life is made out of the love of creation. And again, creation radiates love, so that at every point you can sense the radiating love of creation. Every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. And love is the highest principle in all creation. And everything follows that principle in absolute logic. Creation has absolute logic in all of its laws. The law of striving, of working harder and harder to improve yourself, a continual focus day by day, moment by moment, to improve yourself, the law of harmony, the law of being, which means you have and remain neutral, positive in your thoughts at all times. The creation is a neutral, positive entity. It's neither good nor evil. It's only slightly swayed towards the positive. And the duality is only in the negative and positive pole. Everything is a unity. Your spirit and your body are a unity. the body is a part of the spirit. The spirit and the body are of a different form and matter. But there is a oneness in the universe. Everything is one. Everything is a part of the interwoven web of life. And that's the nature of creation. And if you pull one piece out, it affects the whole. Billy knew at a very young age that everything which exists in the whole universe is a manifestation of the might and the infinite and true love of the universal consciousness. Now, here is one of the great and strange ironies of this. The creation is not a heavenly father. It's more of an impersonal spiritual energy. It radiates love like the sun radiates light and heat. The sun doesn't radiate love and radiate heat and light because it's in a relationship with you. It's doing what it does as a part of its existence. And it's the same way with the universal consciousness. There's not a heaven and a hell. We transition from the physical state to the spiritual state and then back into the physical. And this is a cycle. It's called the law of reincarnation. And you are responsible. So the damage you do to the earth, you will come back and live in a world that's been subject to the damage that you have done to it and the damage that others have done to it as well. So the law of personal responsibility is critical. And that's one of the bad aspects of religion, is religion has taught us that there is a Heavenly Father that is responsible for us. We are responsible for everything we think, for everything we do. We have much more power than we realize, and the power is in our own thoughts. Our own thoughts manifest the circumstances of our life. And I wanted to read a little something from The Might of Thoughts that talks about depressions. Depressions are based on acquired flattened feelings, which unambiguously, without any doubt, are determined by a conscious or an unconscious negative thinking. In other words, if negative thinking occurs and it stabilizes, or your negative thinking deepens, then it is unavoidable that you can fall into these depressions. And your thoughts can be locked into a rotating cycle of negative thoughts. Positive thoughts must be learned, and every human being must practice neutral, positive thinking. One of the things that you can do if you find yourself straying into the world of the negative is think of a wishful dream. In other words, think of a state in your life where there has been, for even a fleeting few moments, a state of happiness, a state of neutral, positive thoughts, and focus on those states, those times in your life, and hold on to those thoughts and clarify those thoughts. Those are part of your self-education. Self-education is thereby quite especially important because the principal factor of the personality is also based on it. And with that, the principal factor of the consciousness, which the thoughts are ultimately formed, which can be warm or cold. and therefore full of feelings or unfeeling. So we need to practice neutral, positive, equalized thinking. And here in the book of Emmanuel, Emmanuel's telling you to look up towards the stars. And why would you want to do that? Well, because that's going to put you in a neutral, positive state. When you look up at the beautiful, radiating light of all the stars in the cosmos, you're going to completely go away from all your problems, all your rotating negative thoughts, and look up and focus on the incredible grandeur of the cosmos, of the universe. You see, there are certain techniques that you can use in your thinking to maintain the neutral, positive, happy state of mind that we're told is a creational natural law. Now, it's sometimes not easy to learn these skills, but they must be carried out. You must learn neutral, positive thinking. And one of the keys is the wishful dream. In other words, you're starting to visualize. Visualize in your mind a beautiful starry sky. You've all seen one before. That's a place to start. You've got a million memories from your own consciousness that you can go back in. Learn to clarify your thoughts. Sometimes it's good to speak to yourself and rotate not negative thoughts, but neutral, positive thoughts. Feelings are very important as well and are therefore extremely useful. Consequently, they must not simply be fought and eliminated. Your feelings arise out of your thoughts. Okay, what else does it say here? That also must not happen by means of a positive... Okay, let me continue here. It must never be forgotten nor disregarded that feelings have an existential and thereby life-sustaining significance and function. Let me give you an example. You look up at the beautiful starry night, you're going to have thoughts, but you're also going to have feelings. Those feelings are a part of your ability to bring that thought back into your mind at a later time. You'll remember not only the visible aspect of that beautiful starry night, but you'll remember the feeling that you had at that time. Look down at your garden at the plants growing there. That will stir within you a feeling. So hold on to that feeling as well, that positive feeling. Clarify those thoughts, those feelings. See, feelings are very important. It must never be forgotten or disregarded that feelings have a life-sustaining significance and function. If there were no feelings, which are created by the thoughts, then the thoughts would run hot. They would be out of control, so to speak, because they would have no opportunity to discharge. So feelings are the discharging of your thoughts. Thus, the thoughts need an opportunity to discharge their powers. So the feeling, you know, when you're out in nature and you sense the visible, the radiating love of creation, it will produce in you a feeling. Well, that feeling is a discharge of the thoughts that you had when you observed the incredible beauty of nature in its repeating patterns. Remember, the branching structure in trees, the branching structure of the lightning as it goes through the sky, the branching structure of the rivers. If you've ever seen the globe from space, the rivers go down in a branching structure. And they look just like the veins in your body. You see, creation is repeating itself in all of these wonderful patterns all over. There is the spiraling arms of the galaxy and the spiraling arms of your DNA. There's a spiral in the seashell and in rivers that haven't been affected by man. You'll see those whirlpools, those spirals that form. All of nature in its incredible splendor is the visible expression of the love of creation. And that's why it keeps expressing itself in these repeating patterns, whether it's the branching structure or the spiral or the rotation of spheres, the atoms rotating around the nucleus, the planets rotating around their stars, and the solar systems that rotate around the galaxies. You see, there is oneness in the universe. There is a oneness to all things. We're all part of a universal intelligence. And all of our spirit forms are almost like a little spark of the universal consciousness. So we're all connected also by a subconscious. And I'm starting to see evidence of this in humanity on Earth, that there is a collective subconsciousness. You see, everything which exists in the whole universe is, again, a manifestation of the might of the true love of creation. All the beaming stars, and in Billy, the beaming stars as a young boy, they stirred in him an unfamiliar longing for the vast distance in the faraway world. Have you ever had a unfamiliar longing for the vast distances? You know, Billy heard his own voice say, since ancient times you have lived among the stars. You know, some spirit forms on the earth are 8 to 12 million years old. And those are people that came to the earth in spacecraft millions of years ago or hundreds of thousands of years ago during, you know, times like Atlantis and Lemuria or the civilization of Pelagon. There was also civilization in the southwestern United States that destroyed itself with atomic weapons. The human race, it didn't originate on Earth. The human race in this galaxy, the biggest, most mature aspect of the human race began in Lyra Vega millions and millions of years ago. And the Lyrians and the Vegans went all over our galaxy and they populated other worlds, sometimes through war and sometimes in a benevolent way. And that's probably a story better off left for another day when we can talk about Lyra and Vega. And we can talk about the people from Beta Centauri that came here during the time of Atlantis and Lemuria. I hope you've all enjoyed the show. I've had a great time presenting it to you today. Have a great week, and we'll be back once again in the Billy Meier Case. Talk to you later.